I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded
fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we will dive back into the architecture world, and we are joined by Jeff Mingay. Jeff is an architect based out of Canada. He's done extensive work in the Pacific Northwest and also in Vancouver, as well as he's starting to do some in Minneapolis. He got his start with Rod Whitman, doing some work with three of the, you know, kind of most prolific new courses in Canada: Sagebrush, Cabot Links, and Blackhawk. And welcome on, Jeff.
Oh, thanks for having me, Andy. Appreciate the interest.
Yeah, we're excited to learn a little bit about you and kind of your work and all of the things you know that we don't know.
All right.
So why don't you give us a little background on yourself and how you got into architecture?
Yeah, I was fortunate to grow up playing golf at Essex Golf and Country Club in Windsor, Ontario, which is just across the river from Detroit. Essex was it's a Donald Ross course from 1929. So as a kid, I mean, I just took a unbelievable interest in the golf course. You know, my brother and I joke around occasionally, you know, he was able to focus on the ball and the hole, became a real good player. And I kind of hit shots and then looked around and thought, man, how'd they build that bunker? How'd they build that green? You know, why is the golf course laid out this way? It was just something in me that, you know, an instinctual interest in that sort of thing as I looked at the course. But then I was lucky too, because my dad is an avid book collector, and I used to go to his office and look through his bookshelf, and it still amazes me that, you know, we're talking back in the late 80s when I was a teenager. You know, my dad had all the books. He had Golf Architecture by Mackenzie, you know, he had Scotland's Gift by C.B. MacDonald, all those classic books. So on top of taking an interest in Essex, I had all this literature and all these resources that my dad had, and I started reading all those books, which was fun and educational. And so I started, you know, in 16, 17 years old, I started writing letters to architects saying, you know, I want to do this. I found out it's a real job and you can do it. And I consistently got the same advice from guys I admired. You know, a young Tom Doak answered my letters, Pete Dye, Bill Coore, you know, this is again back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I kept hearing that, you know, if you want to be a good golf course architect, you got to really learn how to build on the construction end of things. You know, anyone can come up with theories, philosophies, but if you don't know how to actually implement that stuff on the ground, you know, you're not going to be as good as you could be. So long story short, I subsequently found out that there was this Canadian guy named Rod Whitman who had worked for Coore & Crenshaw, worked for Pete Dye. You know, he worked in a way, design-build method. Mm-hmm. So I just pestered Rod for, I can't even remember how long. And he finally called me up and said, all right, if you want to work, I'm doing something in Edmonton. Show up, you know, whatever date it was. And I jumped on a plane immediately, lied to him that I knew how to run a bulldozer, and ended up working for him for 10 years.
So what was it like when, you know, he said, get on the dozer? Like, what was the first experience?
That's a funny story. I'm glad you asked it, because I actually just told this story the other night when I was in Minneapolis. I showed up on site, and the 10th hole at this golf course was going to play up and over a hill. So the objective was to cut the hill down a little bit to reduce the severity of the up and over tee shot. So first day on site with Rod, he says to me, "You've run a bulldozer, right?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, well, what you need to do is cut that hill down. Here's where the 10th tee is going to be. Here's the line of the tee shot. Cut the hill down. Take the cut material down to the tees and flatten off a teeing area." I said, "Okay." So he leaves, and I get in the bulldozer. No clue even how to start it, run it, nothing. I finally found the key, started it up, started messing around. Rod came back, I don't know, a couple hours later, and he looked at what I'd done, and his first response was, "You've never run a bulldozer before, have you?" And I said, "Yeah, you caught me." But we hit it off, and he gave me an unbelievable opportunity to just jump into it, you know, literally jump into the fire, get on that bulldozer, get on that excavator, get on that tractor, get on that sand rake, you know, and finish the green. And, you know, it's just, it's the foundation of everything I do now. And I'll forever be grateful to him for putting me in that position without any. Rod's an easygoing guy. That's what's so great about him. And he just gave me a remarkable opportunity.
It's interesting. So do you think there's any, you know, I think, from Keith Reb talked about Bill Coore being pretty easygoing and laid back. Do you think, are there common traits that you see with some of the great architects that you've, you know, been able to meet? And do you think there's any common traits?
That is certainly one of the traits of guys that I really admire, you know, Rod, Bill, Tom Doak, Gil Hance, that whole vein of guys. And it all, you know, I often think it kind of all stems back to Pete Dye, you know, who was easygoing too. You know, if you get a passion for architecture and you want to work, let's go to work. You know, it's not about landscape architecture degrees and, you know, certifications and all this stuff. I mean, you just got to get out there in the field and work, and the best work comes from a sincere passion for architecture. You know, I mean, Rod always said on our jobs, you know, we'd have a guy come to us, like, no offense to anyone, but we'd have a guy come to us and say, "Okay, I just spent the last 6 years working for Nicholas or working for Palmer or working for this guy or working for that guy. I've been shaping for 25 years." Rod would put that resume aside and take the kid who'd never, like me, like I was, who'd never been on a project before and just had a passion for golf architecture. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a difference between having a sincere passion for golf architecture and simply knowing how to shape golf courses.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Pete Dye recognized that a long time ago. You know, Rod, I mean, you know, Rod had no experience really when he went to work for Pete Dye at Austin Country Club in the early 80s. You know, Bill Coore, I mean, his background is in like Greek philosophy or something, you know, and from college. And Rod too, he's got something like a philosophy degree. I studied political science, you know, but we all came into the thing with passion. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about that. But back to your question, you have to take an easygoing attitude to bring people like that into the mix, you know. And again, all those guys I named are just kind of like, you know, don't sweat it. I mean, we're going to go out there and we're going to work hard and get it done with passion. And I think that's what you're seeing in a lot of architecture these days. You know, you're seeing a lot more passion than you are seeing just business, you know, like guys running a business and building courses and moving on to the next course. You're seeing people who really care and are really delving into it and are really trying to be craftsmen, you know, with their work. So it's a neat era, you know. It's a neat era to be involved in, even though there's not a lot of golf courses being built comparatively. There's certainly a lot of quality work being done, which is really cool, I think.
Yeah, I'm interested. You know, you're a part of this design build movement, and it seems like it's getting to be more of an even split, you know, like this, the design build philosophy. Obviously, you know, you spend a lot more time on site. Do you think that gives you obviously an inherent advantage when you're
no doubt.
Yeah. So, I mean, you learn a lot of the nuances, right?
Well, exactly. exactly. I mean, I'm lucky that when I explain to my clients right out of the gate that, you know, plans are entirely conceptual, because as you just said, when you're permitted to spend time on site, things change. You know, things change as you're shaping. Things change as you continue to study the situation and tweak the design. And so to charge clients, you know, an incredible amount of money to sit in Toronto and design a golf course in Seattle is both a waste of time and a waste of money. You know, I would rather have my clients spend money on me being on site, paying attention to details as things get built, and then also participating in the shaping as well. You know, that's money well spent. And, you know, again, usually that's part of my, you know, part of my spiel when I come to a potential client or a new client and explain to them that they're going to get the best results out of that method, simply because, you know, you got to pay attention. It's like Ben Crenshaw said, you know, what's the most important thing in golf architecture? And it's time. Mm-hmm. You know, you need time to be out there, time to build, time to look, time to tweak, you know, and all those sorts of things. And the more time you have without wasting time or taking too much time, you know, you're going to end up with the best result possible.
I mean, I know you write a good amount, and I think it's a lot like writing is like when you have the time to really write something and you keep working on, you know, things that they always turn out better.
Absolutely. And that's a perfect analogy. It really is. But then you just have to find that balance, right? Because, mm-hmm. you know, if you think of an author who just wants to continually refine, you'll never get the book published. So, you know, there's a fine line of when the thinking and the tweaking and the changing, you know, has to stop. It reminds me of a funny story. Dick Youngskap, who was the developer of Sandhills, he developed a golf course that Rod actually worked on with Pete Dye at Firethorn in Lincoln, Nebraska. And we were sitting down at dinner one time with Dick Youngskap, and he told the story of Pete Dye showing up at Firethorn during construction. And every time Pete showed up, he wanted to think more. He wanted to tweak more. And they were getting close to the finish line. And Dick Youngskap, who's got a great personality, you know, he finally said, "That's it. You're done. We're grassing. There's no more changes." Otherwise, he felt they were never going to finish the golf course.
Yeah.
So, you know, so again, there's a bit of a talent in realizing that, okay, we've done all we can. That's done. Because I think, you know, with our artistic minds, I think we'd never be done if we didn't have to be done, right?
Mm-hmm. So you've touched on Pete Dye a couple times, and you know, we're the tour's at a Dye course now, and then obviously the Players is coming up, and we had the Heritage at Harbortown. If you were going to say, you know, what's the one thing that you would take away from Pete Dye as an architect that, you know, really kind of like that you admire the most, what would it be?
Well, I would say the guts and the strength to be bold with your work. You know, I deal with a lot of client clubs, and I just find golfers, and I say this to my committees and memberships that I work with, golfers are soft these days, you know? Mm-hmm. They want the golf course to cater to them. You know, you do something bold, whether it be a deep bunker or a big contour and a green or something, and they're most of them are upset all the time. You know, they don't want golf to be golf. And, you know, we all know Pete actually gets a bad rap, I think, because, you know, he got this reputation that all he did was build hard golf courses. I don't believe that to be true at all. I find a lot of his golf courses to be really fun, but there's mm-hmm. always bold features out there, you know, that excite you to play. And I just get this sense all the time when I'm working at clubs that people want to tone it down because they don't want to, I mean, it sounds simplistic, but I often say they don't want to play golf. I mean, when you go to Scotland, you go to Ireland, you know, you see stuff that is like bold and hard. And, you know, I talked to Pete Dye one time at the, I think it was 2008 PGA Championship at Oakland Hills. I just happened to run into him and we were talking about things, and, you know, he said, "Let me tell you something." And I was all excited. he asked, you know, why do you think people play golf? And I thought I was going to get some philosophical answer. And he said simply, because it's hard.
Yeah.
You know, part of the reason you play is because you always think you can do better next time, you know? And, you know, and again, I really give him a lot of credit, and I think he built his reputation on not being afraid to be bold. And that doesn't mean make every hole bold or every course bold, but you need some stuff that's going to excite people, want people to come back to play and
thrill,
come back to try and thrills and try to conquer some things that are seemingly difficult, you know, are difficult.
That's what I think. So you hit the nail on the head with golf in general. Like, you know, the thing that keeps everybody coming back is the fact that it's like unconquerable. You know, you never, I've played some of the best rounds of my life, and I walk off the course and I'm like shaking my head because I'm like, dang, I three putted from 12 feet, and you know, it could have been even better. And that's like the beauty of golf, is that you're never fully satisfied.
Exactly. And it's challenging these days, you know, I mean, especially for a guy like me, you know, I'm still in the midst of building my career. I'm not a Doak or a Coors or even a Hance or anything like that yet. But, you know, when you're working at a club and you see an opportunity to do something bold, you know, your first thought is, okay, how is this going to be received? You know, am I going to get fired here because I want to do something that's got some real character? But, you know, and I follow through because I do think of guys like Pete Dye, and other architects, you know, you need those type of features, you need those types of holes out there. But you're always thinking about the potential threat when you're about to build something that you know is going to be controversial. But as you know, I mean, all the great holes in the world are polarizing, you know, you either love them or hate them. If they just sat in the middle, they'd be no good. Right.
Yep. It's very true. I mean, like, Mackenzie thought Cypress Point was going to be just maligned, but, you know, because of how bold he went, and then, you know, the natural beauty kind of overshadowed everything. But I'd be interested, you know, you've talked a lot about, you know, dealing with memberships, and I know you've done a lot of, you know, restorations and renovations of clubs. Like, what would you say, you know, would be like the one thing you wish every membership committee would do, like, you know, having the experience, like, what's the one thing that, like, really great membership committees do?
Well, you know, it's kind of like Alistair McKenzie. I think it was Alistair McKenzie years ago said that the best number for a committee, the makeup of a committee, is an even number less than three, right? which is one.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of the experience I had at the Derrick Club. You know, we in Edmonton, Alberta, we completely rebuilt an existing golf course. It's basically a new golf course. And they did a very nice job of allowing us to deal with a two-person committee. Our plans were vetted through Green Committee, Long Range Planning Committee, Board of Directors. But once we got the thing through the membership, through the club, we simply dealt with two board members on construction schedule and financing in budget issues, right? Mm-hmm. So we avoided what is most typical, where, you know, you've got 12 people in a room. You can't come to consensus. I mean, golf architecture is very, very subjective, as you know, too. Everybody has different opinions. And that's fine. It's wonderful. That's one of the reasons we have such a great variance of golf courses, you know, and variety is so important to golf. But when it gets down to it, and you've hired an expert architect, and you've hired, you've got an expert super golf course superintendent, expert shapers, contractor, I mean, you got to let them go to work. You can't have 12 people in there giving their opinions on every tee, every bunker, every green. Yeah. I mean, it's like spinning your tires in mud, you know, when you're dealing with that situation. So I think the Derrick Club, even though it's a difficult thing to do politically, the Derrick Club provides an excellent example of how to just let the people that you've hired go to work and not have interference with too many design opinions get thrown in there.
You know, I think the other aspect of it is, you know, most members of private clubs are very, very successful in their trade, you know, and they aren't, right, they aren't used to being, you know, not the boss.
Exactly. So. But the other problem too, like I said earlier, is that, you know, I always use this example. You know, Jack Nicklaus won 18 professional majors and 2 U.S. amateurs because he was able to tailor his game to varying courses, right? When he was at St. Andrews, he had to play different than he did when he was at Augusta. Mm-hmm. And he had to play different when he was at Pebble Beach than he played at Augusta, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's why he was such a successful champion. The problem with so many club golfers is they want the exact opposite to happen. They want the golf course designed and set up to cater to them. And I'm constantly confused by that because, as we talked about just a minute ago, I mean, the attraction to the game is the challenge. Mm-hmm. But so many golfers they run from the challenge and they just complain about the condition of the bunkers or where the tees were set up or where the hole was cut. You know, we all hear that all the time, and it's just such an ironic thing. You know, and I can be a little sarcastic sometimes, and I ask people again, did you really want to play golf, or what kind of game are you trying to create here that's actually not golf? You know,
well, a perfect example is where I play in Chicago. I started playing there a couple years ago, and I've always been a player that hit a right to left tee shot. And this golf course, like, you know, it had some shots where you had to move the ball left to right. And
yeah,
over the years, I've become so much more well rounded of a golfer because I've learned and been forced to learn how to hit the ball left to right. And
yeah,
you know,
great example.
And it's just that's the way people need to look at these things, is looking at it and saying, like, you know, like, if I play a course that really tests certain aspects of my game, you know, I, you know, while still being fair, like, you know, I think that, and I'm, you know, like, not having nowhere to bail out, nowhere, like, but like, where you have this test, like, it's only going to make you better.
Right. And I think that's why, you know, Pete Dye has gotten a bad rap, is that he was, you know, Sawgrass, you just mentioned the Players Championship. I mean, Sawgrass is so cool because it's like overkill of presenting you with varying challenges. You know, if you actually look, I learned so much playing TPC Sawgrass on the old Sega, video game yeah, system years ago, right? Because they'd show you the overview of the hole. And when you know a little bit about architecture, you could see that so many of the holes and so many of the angles are set up, you know, for cut off the tee and then draw into the green. Mm-hmm. You know, and with the 80s, when the golf course opened with the 80s clubs and balls, you know, those types of shots meant something. And I think why a lot of those pros back then, I'm just being speculative, but my suspicion is that most of those pros out there, when Pete Dye put that, you know, precise challenge out there and they couldn't hit the shot that was required, it just burned them up, you know? Mm-hmm. And Pete always talked about, you get into those guys' heads, that's when you really got them, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, when he was asking them to do, you know, shape it this way, shape it that way, hit it low, hit it high, you know, it's such a smart design. I mean, I still can't believe he took a swamp and ended up with that. I mean, it's arguably, I mean, I don't want to overstate this, but I think Sawgrass is arguably one of the greatest achievements in golf architecture. You know, to be, again, first of all, to facilitate golf in what was really a swamp, mm-hmm, and then to come up with so many holes that are just, you know, fascinating from, you know, the look of the holes, the strategy behind the holes. I mean, I just got tons of respect for Mr. Dye and that golf course. And I know I've kind of argued with a lot of people who feel differently about it, but that's my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, it also, one of the things it does so well is it doesn't really favor a specific type of player. You know, you see a great variety in the leaderboard and winners there year in, year out,
yeah,
because I think that's what he does so well, is that he always, you know, there are always angles and ideal angles. The ideal angles usually come with a little bit of risk. And then, you know, and then he asks you to hit shots, and it's, you know, it's very clear, you know, what you need to do. And if you pull it off, you usually have a great look at birdie or eagle. And if you don't, you're going to be, you know, and you don't miss in the right spot, you're going to be in a world of hurt.
Right. And the sad part about that, I mean, I love the way you just described that, but the sad part about that is the way club and ball technology is now. It's taken so much away from exactly what you just described, because the ball is just being hit, you know, super high,
yep,
monstrously high and monstrously long.
No spin.
And, you know, no spin, you know, so all that shaping and high, low stuff is gone. And it's just, it's pretty sad, actually, you know, when you think about how fascinating the game was even 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, I think about it. I had Aaron Oberholzer on, and he talked about the first time he hit a Pro V1. You know, he was a pro golfer at the time, and he was like, holy cow, this is so much different. And how, I mean, you look at, I think it's, the Pro V1's obviously been the one that's kind of really changed the game, because when it, as soon as it shifted from professional 90s to those, that, I mean, it, the spin just year over year has gotten less and less, and ball goes further and straighter, and skills diminish.
Yeah, and it just boggles my mind that anyone would think that that's a good thing for the game. I don't understand it. But, you know, I don't know if you've read it yet, but I just finished, I'm friends with Lauren Rubenstein, who's been a long-time friend of mine. I was fascinated that he just wrote that book with Tiger Woods, mm-hmm. celebrating the 97 Masters. And so I was flipping through the book. It's a great book, actually, and the best part about it for me is Tiger talking about Augusta. And he just frankly says that the 1997 golf course is not even close to the same golf course they play today. When we see it on TV, I mean, we watch the 97 Masters, we watch this year's Masters, it looks the same to us. Mm-hmm. But the details that he describes in terms of how different, not only how different the playing equipment is, but what they've done to the golf course because of the playing equipment, is just fascinating. It's really kind of a, you know, it's an architectural read in a lot of ways. And you know, obviously we all know they lengthened the course, they planted trees, they introduced rough, but Tiger's comments on how much they've changed the green surfaces and the green surrounds is interesting, because the golf course has gotten so much longer. They've apparently flattened out a lot of the pin positions, and he says the greens have actually gotten a lot less interesting and a lot more subtle over the years in the pinnable areas, which has really made the golf course less interesting. He said it was way more interesting when it was shorter and the greens were a little bit more severe like they were originally, rather than just playing a big, long golf course with more flat areas on the greens.
It's interesting, and that book is one that's on my list of to-dos. But it boggles my mind how anybody... how this theory of Tiger proofing came about, that like, okay, we've got this guy that's come on tour and he hits it so far, like what we need to do to level the field is to make golf courses longer. Like what, like you're, that makes no sense whatsoever.
He admits that in the book too. He says all they did was play right into his hands, because he could take advantage of his strength even more so the longer the golf course got.
Yeah. All you did was just remove, and now we live in this era where all the golf courses are built for power players, and sure enough, power players dominate the game.
Right. There's no, you don't see any Corey Pavins around anymore, which really sucks too. I mean, I remember following Corey Pavin at that 2008 PGA Championship, and I'll tell you what, you want to watch a fun golfer. You know, Corey's out there hitting cuts and draws and low high with long clubs into those greens, because, you know, obviously Oakland Hills was playing really long. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, what if we could watch the good players do this? watch Tiger hit a 4-iron into a par 4 and either cut it or fade it or hit it low, you know. But you then, you know, you'd leave Corey Pavin at that 2008 PGA and go over to the guys on the leaderboard. They hit their drivers. You can't even see the ball. They hit it so high and so far. And then they're down there in wedge territory, and they hit another high one and plunk it on the green. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's no fun to watch. I'd rather watch Ben Hogan and Byron Nelson slinging it around, you know?
Yeah, but that's what I always say to people is, like, you know, people are like, oh, I'd love to see, you know, DJ, Rory, and, you know, Jason Day in the same group. And it's like, well, they're all the same player. It's just like with – it's just like golf course design, what makes a great variety. Like, you know, I'd like to see a guy like, you know, I'd like to see a group that has, you know, one of the bombers in it. Then you throw in like a Kevin Kisner that's like kind of an all-around guy. And you throw in another guy that's a shorter hitter that gets it done a completely different way. That is interesting to watch because you see how these different styles of play, like how they all get it done. And it's fascinating.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the, if people are interested in this topic, I mean, one of the great rounds of ball striking, shot making, I think one of the last great rounds was Nick Faldo in the 1996 Masters. I'll never forget, I don't know if you remember or not, his shot that he hit from 13 fairway into the green. He was on a hook lie, you know, severe right to left lie, but he needed to cut the ball into that green with a back right pin.
Yeah.
And I've watched it a million times. He had Fanny Sunnison on the bag and they were debating, and he had a I can't remember what clubs he was debating, but he was pulling one club and talking and ended up pulling another club, and he just set up over that thing and hit that a bullet cut, and they had the camera perfectly behind him. So you see the trajectory of the ball, and he hit this beautiful cut off this hook lie, and it's just like, man, if you're a golf fan and an architecture fan, you're like, that's what you live for, right? That's what you want to see, and you just don't see it anymore.
Yeah. That's the subtle ways of architecture to really challenge people is give people the, you know, I think William Flynn was one of the first that did it, was give, you know, call for a right to left shot and give them a left to right lie. And,
exactly.
You know, it's I think that's, you know, what intrigue, I think that's what's so cool about golf course architecture is all like the little subtleties that you guys can do that can, you know, really give great players fits. So I'd love, you know, I know, you know, we've gone on a tangent here of professional golf, which isn't the worst thing, but let's get back and let's talk a little bit about your work up in the Pacific Northwest. I think you've done a lot of work at courses designed by A.V. McCann, which, you know, having done you know, a lot of research, he seems to be one of the more underappreciated architects of the Golden Age era.
Yeah, it's amazing, actually. You know, it must have been in the late 90s, I visited Vancouver. And, you know, I'm always making lists if I'm in a particular city, what courses do I need to see in those cities. So I started making a list, and I'm a kid from the East, obviously, so I hadn't spent a lot of time out West at that point. I need to see Shaughnessy, I need to see Marine Drive, I need to see the Victoria Golf Club, I need to see Royal Colwood. I need to see Capilano, obviously. Capilano is a Stanley Thompson course, and then all of a sudden, all the other ones, it was A.V. McCann. I'm like, who is this guy? You know, so I subsequently tracked down a guy named Mike Rist, who's from Vancouver, who had done some remarkable research on McCann's life. He immigrated from Ireland. He was born and raised in Dublin, came over to Canada in about 1912, I think it was. And he was back before he came over, he was in the loop with all the big names. He was a great amateur golfer. So he played the amateur championships around the British Isles, and he knew all the guys, you know, John Lowe and all the guys of the time who were getting into, you know, kind of this Renaissance movement in golf, the golf architecture, especially at the time. So when he got to British Columbia, there wasn't much golf around. He had the opportunity to lay out what is now Royal Colwood in Victoria, where he lived. He tweaked the Victoria Golf Club, where I work now. And he based himself out of there, too. His all his letterhead was Victoria Golf Club. But anyway, he, from those two golf courses, he subsequently laid out courses in Seattle, Portland, all the way down to San Francisco. He actually was the original designer of the California Golf Club before McKenzie and Hunter came in and bunkered it. But he did, he worked from 1913 until he died in 1964. The problem was, is that almost by the end of World War II, most of his original designs had really deteriorated. You know, I've found that out in the research I've done in the, putting together the restoration master plans for his courses. You know, I'll run into guys, you know, I'll pitch the restoration of a particular bunker or whatnot, and I'll run into a member who says, you know, I've been a member here for 50 years. I don't remember that bunker ever being there. And that kind of supports my theory that, you know, especially in the Northwest, when the second, you know, come out of the Depression into the Second World War, I mean, there were all the young guys who would have been on the maintenance crews and whatnot were over fighting a war. Nobody was spending money on golf courses because of the war and because of the Depression. So things started to disappear. You know, bunkers went away and courses changed a lot. People had really forgotten about McCann's prowess and his talents. I mean, during the 1920s and 30s, if you look at historic photos of McCann courses, I mean, they stack right up with anyone else, you know, whether it be Ross, Tillinghast, you know, and all the greats who were working in America at the time as his contemporary. But again, you know, the work deteriorated, and by the end of the Second World War, no one remembered who A.V. McCann was or what his original golf courses were like. And again, the more I delved into his life and his work, he was on par with all the greats of the 20s and 30s. So it's been a real privilege to have an opportunity to kind of dig all this stuff out of the archives and kind of bring some attention to McCann's legacy.
I mean, a lot of your job is being an educator. It seems like, you know, it's interesting. I imagine that the Northwest has its own its constraints, you know, especially with trees and everything, more so than almost any other part of the country.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I mean, not only are there, you know, obviously beautiful trees in the Northwest because of the climate. You know, you get those big, beautiful Douglas firs and really the Northwest is filled with the types of trees you really don't want to see on a golf course most often.
Yeah.
Big evergreens that cause shade and root problems. And
so holly.
You know, all those. Well, that's what I was just going to say. You know, the biggest thing that I've had to fight is that Sahali has long, and I've got nothing against Sahali. I actually have never played there, to be honest with you, but I visited the place. The biggest problem is that Sahali, because of its history of hosting championship golf, it's kind of become the standard in the Pacific Northwest. So every time as an architect and working with the superintendents I work with, when we propose some tree removal, you know, we're always fighting Sahali does it. You know, there's a tree in the middle of the fairway at Sahali. The greens are surrounded by trees at Sahali. How come they can grow grass? You know, so we're always fighting that supposed standard of Sahali being a course that's heavily treed, where trees come into play, where trees shade greens and they don't do anything about it. So I think that Sahali standard has been a real issue for us. But we're overcoming it, as you said, as we dig out all these historical photos and dig out some of McCann's writings. And now people in the Northwest are starting to pay attention to what's been done. You know, as you probably know too, it seems like golf trends move east to west.
Yeah.
In North America. So Seattle's obviously going to be, you know, one of the last places where the wave of any kind of movement gets to in golf. So, but people are starting to become more conscious of the benefits of tree removal and the benefits of being able to see across these golf courses and appreciate the terrain and appreciate long views, appreciate more room to play, appreciate strategies, you know, when you widen corridors. So you're absolutely right. It's a learning process, and a large part of my job is actually being an educator. But I enjoy it. I've always enjoyed history. As I said, I studied political science and history, and I've always kind of been historically minded. So it's fun to, you know, again, dig out the materials and put together the writings and give the presentations. And we've made some good progress in the Northwest, so it's fun.
I think trees make golf easier for good players and harder for bad players.
I agree 100%. You get a fairway that's lined. I know you're a good player, Andy. You know, you get tree line right, tree line left. You can focus on that target, you know?
Yep.
And you guys who are good like that focus.
There's nowhere you have to think about hitting it. You just
exactly.
have to hit it straight.
And as you know, the other people, I mean, how many fairways do they miss every round? A lot.
Uh-huh.
So when you're in a tight tree line golf course, you're exactly right. Easy for the good player and a lot more difficult for the higher handicap, which is the exact opposite of what the ideal in golf course architecture is, right?
Yep.
You want a golf course to challenge the best players and at the same time allow everyone else to have fun. And, you know, and I use that argument a lot too, because A.V. McCann preached that forever. One of the most fascinating things I've read about from him, actually, is later in his life, a kid wrote him a letter. I think it was in the – he died in 64, so I think it was in the 50s or early – yeah, late 50s. Early 50s, because they were in the letter, they were talking about the 1951 U.S. Open at Oakland Hills, you know, when Robert Trent Jones narrowed the course, you know, bunkered the hell out of it, and Ben Hogan won and said he conquered the monster. You know, it was the first time that, just making a golf course super hard got a lot of publicity and a lot of attention. And McCann was totally against that. And the kid asked him, you know, I want to go into golf architecture. What do I need to learn? And he said, well, don't pay attention to Oakland Hills. All you need to do is read the two chapters in Bobby Jones's autobiography about the development of Augusta National. You know, he thought that they achieved the ideal in terms of creating a course that challenged the best and catered to the enjoyment of everyone else along the lines of St. Andrews. And, it opened up with 22 bunkers in 1932. It had big, wide fairways, but they could play the Masters there, you know? And that's a neat piece of advice. I always go back to that McCann quote about who would think that Bobby Jones's autobiography is an architecture book? But it is. It's those two chapters.
It's ironic that that same person that kind of did that to Oakland Hills did the exact same thing to Bobby Jones's Augusta.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's also interesting that Bobby Jones was working with him when he started. You know, changing 16 and 11. And yeah, it's, boy, if you could bring Jones back and talk to him about working with McKenzie and then Trent Jones on that golf course, boy, would that be something to listen to.
Yeah, yeah. I read something about this year that Golf WRX did an article with Robert Trent Jones Jr., and he was talking about it, and it just had me shaking my head the whole time, you know, talking about how, you know, they needed to remove bunkers or add bunkers and add water hazards and all this stuff. And it's like, God, you just don't get it. it's interesting. Like, I think like the runoff areas that you see are so becoming so popular now in golf, like is a perfect example for like the regular player, that 15 handicap, so easy. You grab a putter and you putt it, you know, but then for the better player, you look at it and you're like, what do I do here? You know, and you're like, do I hit a 60 degree? Do I use like a gap wedge and hit a low checker? Do I bump it? Do I use a putter? Like, and all that question puts doubt into your head, and that's when you win as an architect against a good player, is when you make them think. And
exactly.
And but for the regular player, but like when you think about it, it's contradictory. Like, oh, these runoff areas are easier, but in actuality, they're harder for the good player.
Exactly. I agree 100%. I mean, I love short grass for the reasons you said. It fits into the equation of creating the ideal in architecture, right? As you just said, the higher handicap, they can knock it out of the green with a putter. Probably, you know, maybe not close to the hole, but at least they're keeping the ball moving. They're on the green. And then the shot options, the tight lies, present the challenge for better golfers. But yeah. I lately I've been playing the devil's advocate on that one. I mean, I love short grass, but you know, it's architecture, all forms of art really, but you know, there's always trends in architecture. And I think sometimes the short grass areas kind of are starting to get a little bit out of control, to be honest with you. You know, everywhere, because I run into it with members too. Everywhere there's a fall off up the side of the green, you know, there's always a suggestion about putting short grass down there.
Yeah.
And as I said, I'm not opposed to it, but at the same time, I mentioned this earlier, at the same time, I think variety is most important. You know, you want to have holes where when you miss, sometimes you're in a bunker. Sometimes you got that tight lie on the short grass, like you just mentioned. Sometimes you're in rough. I mean, it's still a golf shot, right? That should be part of the equation to be playing out of 2 or 3 inches of grass, too. I mean, you just have to make sure that it's not happening every time you miss a fairway and every time you miss a green. That's when the golf course gets monotonous. So I think we need to use all of those hazards, you know, and kind of sprinkle them around equitably so that you get all kinds of different shots.
Yeah, something I don't see a lot of that I kind of really like are grass bunkers.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You don't see them a lot. I've got an article sitting in front of me right here, actually, because I've been working on this McCann stuff and trying to do things, minimize bunkers on golf courses. And there's an article that McKenzie wrote in the, Alistair McKenzie wrote in the American Golfer magazine in 1933. And he was talking about how golf courses have too many bunkers and actually advocating the use of grass hollows. And you're absolutely right. In all my travels, you rarely see grassy hollows. Pete Dye courses, you see a lot of grassy hollows. But it's an interesting thing that I put some thought into. I don't know if I particularly know how to effectively use them, but in lieu of bunkers, it's an interesting thing to think about, that's for sure.
I mean, it's another example of, like, for compared to a bunker for, like, your beginner, a grass bunker is worlds easier, you know?
Right.
And then for the better player, it's worlds harder.
And most importantly, it's less expensive to build and less expensive to maintain.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and that's what McKenzie was advocating back in 1933. And that's actually a fascinating thing to me right now. You know, I mean, I've had this dream of one day having an opportunity to build a bunkerless golf course. I don't even know if it would fly, you know, which owner developer would let you do it, and would golfers recognize that you could do something interesting and without any sand bunkers. You know, it's something I'd love to give a shot to, you know, interesting greens, interesting contour in the fairways, and figuring out a way to do it without any bunkers. You know, I'd love to take on that challenge someday.
Like we've talked a lot about Augusta, but I think one of the most overlooked great holes out there is the 14th, and it's bunkerless.
Oh, absolutely.
And yeah. I think it would be very cool. I was going to ask you about, you know, what kind of new architecture ideas or trends get you most excited, and that kind of feel, you know, doing something bunkerless. It could be cool. You could do it. It couldn't be less than 18 holes too. You know, you'd have to have a good piece of land, I imagine, though, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was just thinking the same thing. I mean, a nice rolling sandy piece of ground with good contour would give you a lot more options than a less interesting piece of land. That's for sure. But I don't know. This is going to sound like a sales pitch, but I mean, I've always been kind of obsessed with economy, you know, and efficiency. Mm-hmm. I would rather have someone go play one of my golf courses and say, geez, did you see what Minge did for $1 million, rather than say, geez, did you see Minge spent $50 million over there and I don't even want to play there. You know, so trying to figure out ways to be efficient and economic you know, is a very interesting challenge to me. And obviously, from a business standpoint, I mean, geez, that's what you should be providing your clients with, you know?
Yeah. Well, it lessens, like, especially at a public course, you know, that all the costs just get passed to the consumer, you know, and that's why we see $250 greens fees at a lot of these places. Like, why does Whistling Straits cost $400 a place? Well, they moved an insane amount of earth to build the golf course.
Right.
And, you know, like, you look at other places, like, I think one of the things that I'm fascinated at from, like, this kind of discussion is the Loop. You know, the Tom Doak's recent course, and I know Dan Hixon is doing a reversible course that opens this year up in Oregon, but the idea of two golf courses in one.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to get to the Loop. I tried to get there last summer, and I just couldn't work out the schedule, but I'm hoping to get there this year because it is a fascinating concept. Amazing. I actually looked at a piece of ground in British Columbia to redo an existing golf course that had this similar potential. Unfortunately, the project didn't go ahead, but I pitched it to the owner there, and you know, he was quite confused by the idea, you know. And I remember hearing Tom Doak say that he'd been considering he may have said this to you when you talked to him recently, but you know, a lot of people wouldn't get that concept. You have to find the right owner who's willing to take on that, you know, that, I guess it's just an oddity that a lot of people wouldn't quite get. So it's cool that they gave Tom an opportunity to do that. I can't think of a better guy to give it a shot, to be honest with you. I'm sure it's great. Frank Pont, actually a friend of mine who's based in Amsterdam over in Europe, he's working on two projects where he's going to be doing reversible courses over there in the Netherlands. So I don't know, maybe it's going to become a bit of a trend, and I don't think it'd be a bad thing in spots where we can figure it out.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, you know, like, especially for a resort, you know, like it gives somebody a reason to stay an extra day. You know, if you're trying to build destination golf, I think it would make a lot of sense for a members course too, because you'd get a lot, you know, it's variety.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, we're fighting the North American mentality of, I mean, you know, I see things like they don't want, you know, members at golf clubs complain if you move the tee markers back and forth, you know. They always want to play that hole at 167 yards. If you set it up at 137, they walk up and say, why'd you move the tees up? So we're constantly, you know, fighting to create that type of stuff when people don't want variety, you know. They, again, going back to the start of our conversation, they don't want the challenge. They don't want it to be different. It's really mind-boggling to me the way some golfers think.
Something I've started to do in non, like, stipulated rounds is I just play whatever tee box I want to play, you know.
Yeah.
And I've just decided that, like, why do I have to play a specific tee box on a specific day? Like, you know, if I want to play a par 5 up and make it a completely different hole than what it is I play the majority of the time, why not? If I don't want to hit, you know, like if it's into the wind and I don't want to have to hit like a punch 3-wood on a par 3, I'll move up and hit a different shot. You know, it's like, or if I want to move back, like I think that's one of the problems with the game is that we've become so... It's become so focused on score and tees and handicap, and that's what needs to be let go, because at the end of the day, it's just about having fun. And it's like the most fun times I've had on a golf course is like when you just peg it, you know, and there are no tee markers out there.
Yeah. You know, it just reminds me of another amazing concept that hasn't been attempted again, and that's George Thomas's LA South, you know, Los Angeles Country Club South course. When Thomas designed it in the mid 20s, his concept was to create a course within a course. So that golf course, and I know that Gil Hansen and Jeff Shackelford recently restored a lot of those concepts, thankfully, but Thomas wanted you to go out there and basically create enough tee options and enough options to set the pins that you're basically, every day you're out there, you're playing a different golf course. the holes aren't even close to the same because of the options you have in terms of the way you set it up. And really, that just derives from the old course, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the old course gives you a lot of room to flex the distances of the holes, and the greens are so big that, you know, you can take the pins far right, far left, up front, in the back, then the wind starts blowing. I mean, the old course is the epitome of course within a course. And it's a really neat concept that that I think that needs to be resurrected when we have those opportunities.
Yeah, yeah, there's all kinds of little things you can do. So I'm curious, you know, we've talked a ton about kind of golden age architects. What if you were going to kind of create like your ideal architect using like, you know, the different skills, like, you know, routing bunkers of, you know, it could be current, it could be golden age architects. How would you construct the architect, whether it be like routing, bunkering, greens, you know, if we put it into like, you know, three or four categories?
You mean who would be in charge of each category?
Yep.
Ooh, holy cow. That's that might be one of the best questions I've ever been asked. Well, you know, I mean, I go back to my childhood, and it didn't take me very long to realize how great Donald Ross was at routing golf courses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, absolutely fantastic. I mean, rarely do you see a Ross course where the routing's been changed because you can't really improve upon it. So maybe I'd give Ross the routing. I probably sound like a lot of my contemporaries here, but I might put Perry Maxwell in charge of the greens. You know, Perry Maxwell greens, the best ones are just off the chart good, Prairie Dunes and whatnot. Bunkers.
It's hard
to say. You know what I like about bunkering is I like variety. I mean, I think on all my projects, I try to bring a different bunker style to each one because I think that, you know, obviously the bunkers are one of the biggest visual aspects of any golf course. And Bill Coore and Ben Crenshaw and their guys, Jeff Bradley, Dave Axelin, they've done such a good job resurrecting, you know, a great naturalistic Tom Simpson style of bunkering that I think there's been too many copycats.
Mm-hmm.
I'd put Tom Simpson in charge of the bunkering, but you know, right now I think we need a kind of a renaissance in bunker style. We got to get away from that kind of blowout look and start looking at some different things. But that being said, I might put Coore in charge of the bunkering.
Mm-hmm.
Either him or Tom Simpson.
Yeah.
So there you go.
That's it.
Routing, greens, bunkers.
Yeah, that's a formidable three. That's the thing. I like about the Coore Crenshaw. What they do is the variety in the bunkers, like we've talked about. It's like so many different shapes and sizes and different placements. Like they aren't afraid to just throw a bunker right in the middle of a fairway. Like I love that, and I hate when people like are afraid to do that.
Right.
Because that's right where you want to hit the ball.
That's what makes it interesting. I've often got that comment at the clubs I work at. We just restored a center fairway bunker off the tee at Overlake in Seattle, and we brought the committee out to show them what we were up to. And one of the first comments I got is, "Why would you put a bunker there? That's right where I want to hit it." And my response was immediately to say, "That's the point, as you just suggested. You know, now that there's a bunker right where you wanted to hit it, okay, well, now things are going to get fun, right? Can I carry it? Should I play short? Should I play left? Should I play right?" You know, now you've golf's an inherently physical game, as we know, and if you could bring a mental element into the equation, you know, it's going to become more interesting if you take the right attitude toward it.
Mm-hmm. It's, I think it was McKenzie said, like, the bunker, a hazard should always be on the intended line of play.
Right.
And, you know,
the simplest way to describe what I just said. Yeah. You're right.
It's amazing how those old school architects had like I think Riley was talking about it, and they're how concisely they could describe things, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think they were just a little bit more blunt and not afraid of what they were saying, you know?
That could be part of it, no doubt.
So we got a ton of really great Twitter questions I wanted to get to. And you're a big music fan. So K-Voy wanted to know, how has music influenced your work on the golf course?
That's a great question. I would say, firstly, that most parts of my life are inspired by music. I tend to have headphones on all the time. I again take inspiration from all kinds of genres. You know, my tastes in music vary from, you know, I'll be listening to the Doobie Brothers, then I'll be listening to Public Enemy, then I might be listening to a metal band, that I'm interested in. So when I'm out on a golf course shaping, I usually have my music going. And again, I just kind of feel good about things when I'm listening to what I want to listen to. And I think artistically, it just becomes inspiring and puts me in the right frame of mind to be creative and be in the right mood to do good work. So,
yeah, you got to have the right mindset for anything,
Absolutely.
Every aspect of life, I feel like. Let's see. We're going to transition to a musical artist who had a question for you. Micah Iration wants to know, template holes, limiting, or are they a great starting point?
Geez, that's a good question, too. I would never call them limiting. Because, the great template holes really, really give us, they easily explain architectural concepts and philosophies that have stood the test of time and have worked and, make golf holes and golf courses, be what they should be. But on the other hand, I think we got to be careful that we're not just going around, copying, another thing that I've been kind of critical of is, there's been a lot of talk, kind of like the Lacy bunker edges. I mean, there's been a lot of Redan talk, in architecture, in recent years, where everybody's always talking about using side slopes to help people kick balls onto greens. And hey, that's cool. The Redan is one of the most exciting par three concepts there is. And time has proven that, but we don't want to overkill anything, right? We go back to the word variety. So when the template concept presents itself in a certain piece of ground or a certain situation, I mean, it's hard to ignore it because again, that those concepts work really well, but I think we got to be careful not to overdo it too.
I think
that makes sense.
No, I'm a huge Rainer McDonald fan, and I've had the lucky opportunity to have played Shore Acres, one of Rainer's best courses, probably close
for
to 100 times. And you think about the golf course, and he used a lot of great templates, but the best holes on the golf course are the non-template holes because he was given
a good point.
This beautiful land and this unbelievably unique land, and he created unique golf holes that fit the land. And I think that's where you can't allow the templates to, be in a box. But if you were given a dead flat piece of land and you did all template holes, it'd probably turn out really good.
Yeah, well, Chicago is a good example of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Really good example of that. And I think, maybe as Chicago aside, I think one of the reasons that McDonald Rainer templates work so good is that they were so good at fitting those concepts to the existing terrain.
Yep.
They would find the tabletop ridge that tilted right to left, like at the National, put the Redan green on.
Mm-hmm.
Or find a hill to tuck the Alps green behind, an existing hill, not a constructed hill. So, I think when it comes across as being natural rather than forced as a preconceived idea or concept, I think it works a lot better. Although I do love Chicago Golf Club too.
Yeah, it's I'm getting out there in a couple weeks, so I'm excited about that.
Yeah, you should be.
Yeah, I've walked it, but it's a big bucket list one. I'm getting off the list. So I know you've been spending a lot of time in Minneapolis. Talk about a little bit about the golf city, Minneapolis. I feel like it's a little bit under the radar.
I would say so. I've been hanging around there working at Town and Country Club for the last year and a half, working on a master plan. And Bill Larson, the superintendent at Town and Country Club, has been really, he's given me an incredible tour of most of the courses around Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I would go so far as to say that, as far as the depth of great golf courses on the list of courses there, it's one of the deepest lists I've ever seen. I mean, there are extraordinary courses in that city that no one's ever heard of. One of my favorite places there that many people probably haven't heard of is Somerset Country Club, which is in St. Paul, and it's one of Seth Rayner's first golf courses. I think it dates back to, I think it's pre-1920, 1919 or so. Mm-hmm. Wonderful setting, wonderful clubhouse, great course. All the template holes are there. One of the craziest redans I've ever seen is at Somerset Country Club. And then White Bear Yacht Club, which is up in White Bear, Minnesota, which is not too, 20-30 minute drive from St. Paul. I would put White Bear Yacht Club maybe in my top five of courses I've ever played.
Wow.
That's how good it is. Just a wonderful piece of land in a wonderful setting, real lay of the land golf course. And then you've got, Minnetonka, which has hosted a lot of championships, Interlaken. There's a great old Donald Ross course near Lake Minnetonka, I think. It's called Woodhill. A lot of places like that are kind of, as you said, under the radar, but just off the chart good. Midland Hills, another Rayner course. I could keep going and going. It's a deep list of really great golf.
Have you played Northwoods up in Duluth?
Or Northland.
Northland. Yeah.
I haven't been there yet, but you know what? Every golfer I run into in Minneapolis, St. Paul says to me, "Have you been up to Northland yet?" It's a really excited tone in their voice, so I'm excited to get up there.
Yeah, they
it's great.
I've had so many people tell me I gotta go play Northland, and I gotta get up to Minneapolis one of these days.
You want to make sure you go to Duluth in the summer though.
Yeah,
the middle of summer.
I'm a Chicagoan, so I don't have quite as cold, but I know what the constricted season and what golf in May and June can be. Like even June can be just bad.
I think when I was up there last week, and they had snow on the course at Northland. That's one of the reasons we didn't go up.
That's way up there. I apologize. I didn't get the name of who asked this, but what's one piece of knowledge that you take away from working with Whitman on the great projects that you've been working with him on up in Canada?
That's an easy question. I'll never forget when I first started working with Rod and hanging around with him. I was kind of like the kid who had read all the architecture books, and all I wanted to do was talk about theory and concepts and that sort of thing. And Rod said to me one time, he said, "Hey, let me tell you something. About 10% of golf architecture is philosophizing and talking about concepts, and then the rest of the 90% is just hard work." And I've watched Rod work hard. I won't reveal his age, but he's been in the business for a long time. Now, and you still see Rod on the bulldozer. You still see him doing finish work. You still see him out there in the field working hard. And I'll never forget him saying that to me, 10% conceptual, 90% hard work. And I wrote down a quote he said one time that I still think is great. He said to me, "It's the guys with dirt under their fingernails who have the best chance at building the best." And, I think about that all the time in terms of being out there and getting my hands dirty and working hard. So.
Yeah.
That's what I take away from him.
I imagine you don't lose perspective that way, too. It's like a lot of things. You move up in professional life, and you forget what, you know, the job's really about, you know, and sometimes some of the cores of your work.
Exactly. And I've made myself a promise that the day that I don't want to get on a bulldozer or an excavator or go finish a green, I think I've lost the passion that I have. And, you know, I doubt I will. But the day, if that ever happens, I think I'll stop working. Uh-huh. And I'm sure Rod feels the same way.
Yeah. So we're getting to the end. We got to do our fried egg tradition here of overrated, underrated.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, just easy, rapid-fire questions. They've, you know, morphed into, you know, then they end up in debates. But first up, a Canadian tradition, poutine.
Well, it's underrated, of course. There's nothing better than poutine.
You know, it's not as popular in the States, but good poutine is good food, you know?
Well, it's because you guys got to go to Montreal to eat it. Then you'll realize how good it is.
Okay, so if you're in Montreal, you got to get the poutine.
Oh, no doubt. All right. No doubt.
I know my fiance is going there for a bachelorette party of one of her friends, so I'll tell her she has to get poutine. She'll look at me I've got a third eye, though. Cross bunkers.
Underrated, I think.
Okay. I agree. I think they're awesome. You know, I've been getting a lot of flack for my love of the Great Hazard. What would you say about the Great Hazard or Hell's Half Acre?
I love it. Hell's Half Acre, 7 at Pine Valley, right?
Yeah, that's the right answer.
One of the coolest ones I've ever seen, and I absolutely loved it, is when I visited Ben Crenshaw's Austin Golf Club.
No way.
The ninth hole is a cool uphill, long par 5. And they have a great hazard right in the middle of the fairway. You know, big mounds and big sandy areas. I had my jaw hit the ground when I saw it. I thought it was so cool. And what's neat about it is, you know, we philosophize about lateral strategies on golf holes, you know. You know, if a pin's tucked right behind a bunker, you want to drive left and vice versa. You know, we always talk about that. What I love about the Great Hazard is it's a challenge of simply hitting the golf ball, yeah. You know, where you've got to drive it far enough that you can get over that hazard. And if somehow or another you don't hit the proper drive, then the next shot, you know, again, you just need power and length to get over that hazard. It's just quirky in a good way. And I think also part of the challenge of golf, you know, I think they're, you know, we complained about the golf ball going too far and whatnot, but I still think that part of the challenge is it should occasionally be long hitting. And I think that hazard does a good job of that.
I think one of the things I love about it is it's like a really good way, like, you know, most par fives, you hit a bad drive and it's just like, oh, I just lay it up, you know? And like, yeah, it's fine. You know, I'm just going to lay it up to 120 and I'll still have a good birdie chance. Like the Great Hazard, right, like if you don't hit a good drive, like you all of a sudden have like a mid to long iron into the green. And
exactly.
You're like, oh shit, I need to make par.
Right. And that's the thing about designing par fives too, right? There's too many par fives, I think, where it's the second shot that's completely boring. Mm-hmm. You know, so whenever you get a par five where you actually have something to do on the second shot, if you're not going for the green, I mean, those are the great three shot holes.
Yeah, I might start a campaign, more Great Hazards.
I'll try to find one for you.
All right, the Doors.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say either underrated or overrated. I think they're properly appreciated.
Now you got to pick one.
Yeah. I'll go overrated then.
All right.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, it's okay. Music on the golf course.
Overrated. As much as I'm a music fan, I don't particularly enjoy people around me playing music.
All right. That's I was expecting the opposite.
No.
So, all right, we really appreciate the time, and this will probably be going up on Friday afternoon and over the weekend. So, you know, what's being a big music fan, what's one band that we may never have heard of and the listeners have never have heard of that we should listen to this weekend?
Oh, what a great question. Lately, I have been listening to a lot of Gojira.
Gojira.
Yes, G-O-J-I-R-A.
Hold on, Gojira. I'm going to write it down. I'm going to listen to it this afternoon.
They put out a new album a few months ago called Magma. And I've been pretty obsessed with that album. It's very, very well done.
G-O?
It's heavy, heavy music, but okay. It's very well done.
G-O?
G-O-J-I-R-A. Gojira.
Gojira. All right.
And I'll let you in on a little secret. Gojira is what the Japanese call Godzilla.
Oh.
And the band's from France. So there's a small world scenario for you.
This is actually, there's like almost too much there for my head to even conceive. American yeah. movie, Japanese word, French band.
Yes. And the album is one of those great ones that you can hit play on the first track, and it is pretty entertaining right through the end. So
I like
the album concept where it's most fun to listen to it front to back rather than just picking individual tracks. So I think that this album kind of fits that ideal for me.
Just like a great golf course, right?
Hey, there you go. Perfect.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks so much. I'll throw Jeff's on Twitter. I'll throw his profile link into the pod and give him a follow. And, you know, any questions we didn't get to, I'm sure he'd be happy to interact and answer on Twitter. So thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks, Andy. I appreciate the interest. Enjoyed it.
All right. Bye.
Bye.